Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Clyde Prestowitz, the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He is the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. And his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at the Los Angeles Times, The All Too Real Costs of Free Trade to Average Americans. The country is not better off when trade deal gains go only to the very rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clyde Prestowitz.
Good to be with you.
And you're arguing here that the president missed an opportunity in his State of the Union, in your piece in the Los Angeles Times. He did talk about growing income and wealth disparity, but you think he missed out on one of the main causes of it?
Well, I do, and I think, in fact, he was kind of internally self-contradictory, because at one point in his speech, he talked about concluding or pushing ahead with negotiations for what's been called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a new free trade agreement between the U.S. and 10 other countries, including Japan and Singapore, Vietnam, and so forth. And this deal that is being negotiated is a perfect example of the kind of thing that has been contributing powerfully to growing inequality. So the president cannot be consistent saying he wants to attack inequality and also push ahead with this TPP deal.
Well, it would seem to me fairly logical that if we are, as we appear to be, exporting our jobs and importing cheap labor, little wonder the middle class is shrinking and working Americans are basically finding it impossible to survive on what is not a living wage.
Yeah, no, I mean, the argument for a long time has been that kind of laissez-faire, completely open free trade is a win-win proposition. And the argument is that we import cheap, inexpensive foreign goods, and so consumers pay lower prices, and they go to Walmart, and they can afford to buy stuff at Walmart. But what we're discovering is that if you don't have a job, you can't even buy what's at Walmart. Increasingly, what's been happening is that unemployment has stayed high, and people who do have jobs find that their wages are under constant downward pressure, because of the nature of these deals. It's not that there's anything wrong with trading per se, but when you're trading in a way that disadvantages or doesn't take advantage of your strengths, then you're doing something stupid.
And as your article in the Los Angeles Times, Clyde Prestowitz, The All Too Real Costs of Free Trade to Average Americans, the country is not better off when trade deal gains go only to the very rich. Since 1973, the wealthiest 1% of America's share of GDP has risen from 7.7% to more than 19%. Meanwhile, the inflation-adjusted earnings of the median American household has essentially unchanged. So explain, though, the role of trade in making, the 1% of the 1%. I mean, we just learned, by the way, just before Davos, a study came out saying that only 85 individuals on this planet had the combined wealth equal to that of half of the world's population of 3.5 billion. So
yeah, I know. It's amazing. Yeah. Well, I mean, the way it tends to work is that the major global corporations have the potential to produce in a lot of different places. And, for example, General Electric a while back announced that it's moving its avionics division into a joint venture with a Chinese company in Shanghai. Now, avionics is not labor-intensive production. It's not like clothing and textiles and shoes. It's high-tech stuff. It's supposed to be what we're good at. So you scratch your head and say, what's going on? What's going on is that the Chinese have decided that they are going to have an aircraft industry and an avionics industry, and essentially they've said to GE, if you guys want to sell here, you better produce here. And so GE takes that hint, and they move production to China, they move technology to China, and the executives at GE make out like bandits. They get bonuses for making these, quote, smart moves. But the vast bulk of the people who were making avionics will be affected because of the shift in jobs and location of production. And so it's easy, you know, we can look at our economy and we can say, oh, wow, we have a $17, $18 trillion economy, and last quarter we grew 3.2%. Isn't this fantastic? But, you know, if you look at what's happening to the real participants in the economy, and you say, my gosh, of, you know, 98% of all the people had no gain, it's a very skewed statistic and gives a very improper view of what's going on.
Well, I guess the point that you're making in your LA Times article, Clyde Prestowitz, is that from 1973, the wealthiest 1% share of the GDP has risen from 7.7% to more than 19%. And while this is happening, the U.S. trade deficit rose from virtually nothing in the early 1970s to about $540 billion in 2012. So
there's a big divide between the end of World War II and about 1975. U.S. GDP tripled, and the people in the average median workers' income also tripled. Productivity tripled, and wages tripled, and everybody gained. It truly was a win-win proposition. Since 1975, productivity has risen rapidly, and GDP growth overall has risen rapidly, but the average Joe isn't doing any better now than he was in 75.
Well, that's enough to make you a Marxist, isn't it?
Well, it's enough to make you mad.
So why then does this president give us this sort of happy talk in this menu of ideas and executive orders to get around a recalcitrant Congress, to raise the minimum wage to $10, et cetera, for government contract workers, but not really, I mean, you're saying the problem is there's an internal contradiction in his own policies.
He doesn't get it. He does not understand the way that globalization and international trade are affecting the U.S. economy. And he doesn't understand that, you know, he set a goal in one of his previous State of the Union messages to double exports. Well, that's fine. It's great to double exports. But number one, it hasn't happened. Number two, if you double exports while you're quadrupling imports, you haven't necessarily done yourself any good. But I hate to say it because I admire the president and I think he's a really smart guy, but he does not understand this aspect of his policies.
Well, apparently some people do. I mean, for example, the First Lady was out here in Los Angeles, and there were protests over the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, greeting her. Not that she's in any way responsible for the TPP.
No, it's not her fault. But yes, no, I mean, this is one of those cases where ordinary citizens get it. The leadership elite is living in la-la land.
Well, but you can't blame Obama. He's not the first to be in La La Land. I mean, Bill Clinton was a huge...
No, I mean, it has been every American president since the end of the Second World War has pursued the same line on trade. It's our leadership elite in both parties, Republican and Democrat, have embraced a doctrine of internationalization that is seriously flawed. And because the U.S. is so big and powerful for a long time, the flaws were easy to overlook. But as other countries have recovered from the war and become prosperous, and as countries like China and Taiwan, Singapore, the emerging market countries have become more powerful, these flaws have become ever more disturbing. And it really is time for a rethink.
So is this the fault of those people on your side of the argument that haven't been able to get their argument across since this has been going on since World War II, this conventional wisdom about free trade? And I recall the best argument in favor of free trade has always been the specter of Smoot-Hawley. I mean...
Right, yeah. With Smoot, the Depression and even the outbreak of World War II were blamed on Smoot-Hawley.
Which was a protectionist...
Was the protectionist increase in tariffs in 1931-32 in the wake of the crash of Wall Street and the outbreak of the Great Depression. And that has been a big bogeyman for, you know, 70 years or more, 80 years now. But some good academic work has been done on that, which has demonstrated that while that increase in tariffs may not have been the smartest thing we ever did, it in fact had probably a mildly positive effect on the U.S. and a mildly negative effect on the world economy. And in any case, our circumstances today are far removed from those of the 1930s, and we need to deal with today's realities and not yesterday's phantasms and politics.
Well, I think that you've pointed out the real statistics here in your LA Times article, Clyde Prestowitz, that the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation estimated that more than 60% of the 5.7 million U.S. manufacturing jobs lost over the last decade were because of rising imports of manufactured goods. Now, when you were talking about how the CEOs of General Electric get rewarded for moving a plant to China, and one wonders about the defense implications of that as well, since when you move a plant to China, invariably the intellectual property ends up in Chinese hands. How much have American businessmen been sort of hoodwinked by this, the Chinese miracle? Because just prior to having you on, we were talking with a reporter from China who was just booted out. They wouldn't renew his visa. Mm-hmm. And he was telling us about how really, what's going on in China is we always attribute the inexorable growth to the emerging hegemon, but the Chinese leaders are looking over their shoulder at a restive population, and it's not quite the same picture that our investors seem to see.
Yeah, I think it's a complex picture in that a lot of Western business people have, and businesses, companies have made money in China. It's been a good investment for a lot of them. I think that business leaders are in an awkward position, which is made awkward by the lack of an effective U.S. policy. So, you know, let's go back to General Electric for a moment. I mean, China is a big market for avionics and for aircraft, and it's going to be a bigger one. And so if you're a global company like General Electric and you're competing in Europe and in Latin America and the U.S., and if your competitors are going to be selling in China and you're not, you're going to be at a disadvantage. So of course you want to be there. And on the one hand, you have the Chinese saying, look, you can be here, but to be here, you've got to meet certain requirements. You're going to have to do a joint venture. You're going to have to produce here, not just sell here. And you're going to have to do technology work and development here. And if you agree to all that, hey, you know, then you can sell in this market and be able to compete with your other global competitors. So it's easy to understand that if you're the head of GE, that's kind of a deal you can't refuse. On the one hand, if you do it, you will have good market opportunities. And on the other hand, if you don't do it, you can be locked out. And it's going to be the biggest market for your product in the world. So it's easy to understand why Jeff Immelt at GE might want to do that. But here's the missing part. At the same time that GE was making this move in China, Jeff Immelt, the chairman, was the chairman of President Obama's Commission on Jobs and Competitiveness. And so with that hat on, he was supposed to be worrying about creating jobs in the U.S. Now, I don't fault Immelt, but what I wonder is, did President Obama call him up and say, hey, Jeff, what are you doing with this avionics stuff? In my experience, and I'm not trying to pick on Obama particularly, because I've seen all of our previous presidents before him do the same thing. In my experience, the United States government itself does not have a position. There's no counter to the pressure from China to sell and produce and offshore and do R&D in China. The U.S. government doesn't come back and say, hey, wait a minute. You need to do some of that stuff here. And if you do it, here are the incentives that we'll offer. We're absent in the game.
Well, Clyde Prestowitz, I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Clyde Prestowitz, the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books, Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, and his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at the Los Angeles Times, The All-Too-Real Costs of Free Trade to Average Americans. The country is not better off when trade deal gains go only to the very rich. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.